Today on The Grave Talks, Escaping the Dark, a conversation with Melinda Williams. Growing up in an area of the country where there are more churches than stoplights can be a happy and peaceful setting for some. That is, unless you don't fit in or follow the beliefs of everyone around you. Now, if you happen to think differently, or should I say, sense differently, it can be complicated, even a traumatizing existence. That is the life Melinda Williams experienced growing up in the Bible Belt. Because of her sensitivity and gifts, many of the people she thought of as family would eventually shun her, calling her evil, or worse, the devil himself. Melinda knew better. She wanted nothing to do with negativity, evil, or the devil. No, she was more of the light. And as it turned out, those who claimed to be of the light were, in fact, the very dark and negative beings that they so feared. Melinda would find a way to practice her beliefs and share her gifts of positivity with the world. Today, we hear her story on The Grave Talks.
Well, basically, it was when I was like nearly 7 years old. I was six and a half. So basically what happened was I had been like feeling sick, and I kept seeing this white thing. And that's what I called it, because it was white. It had these dark eyes, and it would approach up to me and make faces. And then to the side of that, I started seeing like people that I had known, you know, as a little girl, that had passed away, and they were standing there. And so that was my first time seeing spirits. And basically what ended up happening was the next day I was very, very sick, and I had to go to the hospital. And that I feel was a warning. They were trying to warn me that I was very, very sick. And I actually passed for like 5 minutes.
Wow.
And then, yeah. So, you know, that's when everything really started making sense to me. You know, the people that I'll say raised me, mm-hmm. because I found out later in life they were not my family.
Mm-hmm.
And when the people that raised me, they did not believe in spirits. They thought, you know, it was the devil. And so when I started trying to talk about it and say, well, you know, I was warned that something was going to happen, and they were like, no, you know, and they took me to this church, that church was trying to get, you know, the demon brought out of me and all of this stuff. So it was a very traumatic time, my childhood was. But then I just learned to, I never shut my gifts down. What I do is I keep them open constantly, because to me, if I can help the spirit in any way, then that's what I want to do. But when the people that raised me, they prohibited it. So I had to do it in secret, in quietness, so they were not aware.
So was that what they really felt when you came to them and said, you know, right before you went to the hospital, you were having these visions, or you were seeing these things just clear as day? And then you kind of had that veil open up a bit to you, and you expressed this to your family just in innocence, because this is what your experience was. Was their immediate reaction, oh my gosh, this is the devil, this is demons?
Yes.
Wow.
Very much so. They were just, you know, they were afraid of me. And, you know, and then in school, like I said, I quietened it down. Mm-hmm. I didn't mention it. I had the imaginary friends. And so in school in the third grade, it all came to a head again, because we went to school and the teacher was sitting up there, and she was like telling us one of our classmates over the weekend, they had been involved in an accident, and the little girl passed away. And so she was trying to tell the class, you know, in the best way she could. And I'm like, no, she's sitting here at her desk. And so she was like, Melinda, come up here to my desk. And so then she sent me to the principal. So in turn, they called my family. And I'm like, I'm telling you, I see her sitting at her desk. And so, you know, that's where it really, really amped up with the people that were supposedly my family. You know, that's, you know, they were calling in priests and preachers and you name it to try to get this out of me, saying that, you know, this had to be the work of the devil. But, you know, I was raised in the Bible Belt.
Okay.
And
I was just going to ask, I'm going to guess somewhere in the South.
Yes. I was raised in Tennessee.
Okay.
And so, you know, they were very religious, and I'm like, you know, so they started taking me to church, mm-hmm. you know, every time the doors were open, and, you know, the preacher would be up there preaching. And then, you know, I'd always raise my hand and have something to say or something to ask, because I was like, well, that doesn't make sense, because, you know, because I see things. Is that meaning you're telling everyone that if someone is seeing spirits or seeing things that's of the paranormal? Mm-hmm. I said, is that something that means that we're the devil? I said, this is making me think of the witchcraft, you know, in Salem back in the day. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it's not true. I said, it's just what I see. And I said, I don't understand why you cannot accept and understand, because it was like I had nobody to talk to, nobody to really explain anything to. And I mean, it was just awful. There'd be times that they would just make me stay in my room. I wasn't allowed around people because of they were afraid I would talk about it.
Wow. That must have been really difficult. I mean, when they were trying to essentially, you know, exercise the demons out of you, as they believed was the best form of action for such a thing. I mean, what was that like? I mean, what was the experiences? What were they? Were they just praying over you? I mean, what sort of lengths did they go to try and, you know, make you stop being you, essentially?
Right. Basically, you know, it started out with prayers, you know, and they would do a prayer circle every night. And then, you know, it was still there. And so then they started coming in certain groups of people, and they would come into my bedroom, and they started putting the cross on my forehead, putting oil on my forehead, you know, praying and asking for the devil to be removed. And so then it got to the extreme that I could not take it anymore. And I did run away.
Yeah.
And so then I ran away for 6 months before they found me. And, you know, the people that I ended up was with for that 6 months, you know, they were a biker group, and but they did not judge me. I could be me, and mm-hmm. you know, and I was able to say, okay, you know, your mother is stepping forth, and she's, you know, and I would just give messages, and I was allowed to, because they didn't condemn me or mm-hmm. anything. But then, of course, they ended up finding me 6 months later, and I was sent right back to the place. And then I just learned just to keep my mouth shut about it, act like it didn't exist to those people.
Mm-hmm. So you just kind of had to ride it out, essentially, until you knew you were old enough where you could move on. Is that how it went?
That's exactly how it went. Yes. Wow.
It's such a shame to hear that. I mean, it's not surprising, you know, especially when we look back in time. Hopefully in some areas, things are a little more open than they were, but I'm sure this sort of thing still exists very much in many areas today. Once you were old enough, what age were you where you finally said, okay, I'm old enough, I'm out?
Well, I was 18. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, if I tried to leave before then, they would not hear of it.
Yeah.
And so, but at 18, I got married. Mm-hmm. And of course, my husband at that time, he supported me 100%. He encouraged it. And he's like, you know, and so we were sort of like a team. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had two children together. And then he unexpectedly passed away in 2011.
Okay.
And, but, you know, he was the one that actually pushed me and said, don't be afraid no more.
Yeah.
You know, I finally had a support, but then I was afraid still.
Sure.
And, he just kept pushing it. And so then finally I said, okay, I'm going to do it, and I'm going to put it out there. And if people don't like it, then, you know, that's going to be their problem. And so, you know, the people that did raise me, they were trying to follow me on Facebook and trying to do this. And so I had, you know, I have to keep constantly check to make sure if any of them are trying to connect with me in any way, I have to keep them blocked, because mm-hmm. they start in their crap. Like one time I was doing a live and I was doing card readings, mm-hmm. and basically they got on there and they started saying, you know, she is the devil. You guys don't need to be listening to her. And I'm like, oh my God. So, you know, I've that's a constant thing, but for the last 6 months, it hasn't been so bad because I think I got them all blocked.
Yeah.
And I hate to say it this way, but I don't think they have enough sense to know, you know, that they can make another account and all that stuff. But,
sure.
It is what it is. I mean, I just have nothing to do with them, from the time I got 18.
It's just wacky, you know, that they go from, you know, trying to be this, you know, family that they think they're doing what's right. But then when you don't go along with it, then you're the devil. And it's not, and to correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like you really weren't trying to do anything to harm anybody. You were just trying to live your life and be you.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I would try to give messages, there was a distant relative and their child got run over and it killed them. And we went down there and I was like, Chris is here. He's wanting you to know, you know, and I was trying to give them messages from their little boy that just, you know, that got killed. And oh my God, it was just a mess, Tony. I mean, they grabbed me and put me in the car and told me I had to shut up, that I was only making things worse. And, you know, being a child, I was just looking at, you know, the little Chris wanted his mom to know something. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what I was supposed to do, is give her the message, because he was at me saying, you can see me, you can hear me. So please tell my mom. And so, you know, and then what really got them, it was a hit and run. He was on his bike. And I'm like, he's telling me to tell you that it's a red car. It was a red car. And it was the neighbor that lives down the road. And, you know, and so then the mother started listening to me. She said, let me hear this. And so sure enough, because of what Chris was telling me to tell them, they figured out who had hit him and took off. So, you know, then that part of the, like I said, it was a long distant cousin. Yeah. And in that part, they started really like saying, you know, what she's doing is not a bad thing. And, but at that point, you know, then they kept me away from them. I was not allowed around them because they were sort of like, you know, trying to help me to let other people see this is not a bad thing.
Yeah. It sounds like it's a lot of fear that group of people really had, and that's what kept them, you know, from really accepting a lot of who you are and your abilities. And that's just how they operate, and then, you know, shun anybody and warn everyone of, oh my gosh, this person's not following our suit.
Right.
Yeah, that's once, you know, as you were going through those years, you're young at that time. You're trying to, you have this people who are raising you saying, this is bad. Let's get the demon out of you. Being, you know, young and, you know, anyone who's young can be impressionable. Did you ever sit there and did you ever have a moment where you're like, maybe it is a demon? Maybe what they're saying is true. How did you kind of go over the hurdle? Because I think some would almost go along with that, thinking, well, this must be what it is. How did you kind of get over that hurdle without having anyone on the outside? And we're talking days before social media and internet and everything else, you know, to really accept who you were. How did you not fall into that trap, if you will, of believing those people that were around you, that were essentially the only support system that was there?
Well, basically what I done, you know, I kept hearing it and kept hearing it. And, you know, and I was having the preacher come and all of this stuff. So one night I was sitting in my bed and I was crying and I was like, is this really something of the dark? Is it something, is it the devil, you know? And I'm like, if it is, then, you know, let me know this. And I was, because I always called, and something else they couldn't understand, because I always called him the creator. Mm-hmm. They would say Jesus, and I always said the creator. And so, you know, I was praying to the creator and I said, you know, if this is something of dark, let me know. I said, give me a sign. I said, or if it is of light, if it is coming from you, creator, I said, please give me a sign. And Tony, within 5 minutes, my room like lit up and I seen an archangel and they just looked at me. And then without a doubt, I knew it was of the light. Mm-hmm. It was nothing of the dark. Mm-hmm. And from that moment on, I never questioned it. I just knew it was a gift from the creator.
Yeah. I just had a conversation last night with Andrea Perrin of the Conjuring fame and her books, House of Darkness, House of Light. And we were just kind of talking about a little bit about religions and things of that nature and how so much of it gets caught up in semantics, where at the end of the day, it's like, look, I think everybody's kind of got the same idea, but we're all getting stuck on the words and the verbiage and not just going, look, we're all doing the same sort of thing. And it's just everybody has these words for this or that. But at the end, it's a positive thing. People are going for the light. They're just trying to be good people. They're trying to. Some people have better abilities than others. Some people are more sensitive to smell. Some people are more sensitive to, you know, that third eye and things that are out there. And that's where we can learn and help each other, you know, all around and embrace each other's abilities. It's just obviously it's something you could go into so many depths. As you did get older and once you finally got out of there and you're 18, what were you thinking was going on with you? What were you thinking was your path? How were you kind of digesting? You have these abilities. How did you define them for yourself?
Well, basically I started looking at, with the gifts I had, what can I do to help other people? Mm-hmm. What would it be that would help families get some closure? So basically what I started doing, you're not going to believe this. I started to go around to funeral homes.
Okay.
And basically what I done there was, you know, I would go and I would watch the people and, you know, then I'd see their loved ones. And so basically what I done is I went to the funeral home owner and I explained to him what I done. And, you know, he was hesitant and he was like, all right, he says, I will let the families know. He said, if anybody is interested in what you do, mm-hmm. then I will have them to contact you. That was my first step. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it started out slow, but then I started getting a lot of calls from all over. And so that's when I started realizing this is what I'm supposed to do. This is the thing that I'm supposed to be working toward. You know, I was a 911 dispatcher and there was a lot of things with that, you know, went along with what I was doing. And so, you know, it just all come together as me realizing that what I needed to do is help as many people as I can, especially for people that loses someone suddenly, you know, if there's a murder, whatever, it's for me to step forth and say, you know, let me help you. Let me connect you to your loved one that has passed away. Because a lot of times, you know, I call myself a rescue medium now. And so that's a totally different area of the paranormal. But that was when I started realizing that this is what I'm meant to do. And it's to deliver messages. And like I tell everyone, it's not me. It's coming from the creator. I'm just the vessel that's being used.
What was that like being a 911 dispatcher with the abilities that you have? I mean, I would imagine that, you know, it's not just here's the call. Let me do it. Would imagine there's a more of an emotional response that was going on within you. Not necessarily that you can reiterate as you're going through a 911 call at that moment to the person. But what were you feeling on some of those calls? Was there ever moments that were just very, you're getting messages as someone's going through a trauma in their life?
Yes. And the one that stands out the most, the one I'll never, ever forget, we were receiving 911 calls that there was an accident. And it was like late at night and like 1-2 in the morning. And so this lady, you know, I pick up the next 911 and this lady says, you know, she's screaming and said that she's on the interstate and she sees this accident and she says there's a body laying out in the middle of the roadway. Mm-hmm. And so I immediately, you know, I connected to that. And I said, could you please stop, turn around, go back? We need to check on these people. Mm-hmm. And so she did. And once she got to the scene and she's screaming and it's like, I'm there, I'm seeing what she's seeing. And it was a child. And they had been ejected from the vehicle. And, you know, I was like, you need to turn her over. And she's like, how do you know she's face down? And I'm like, just turn her over. We got to check for pulse. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I would say things like that, and then it would freak people out. But it was just a common thing to me, because if I'm seeing it, that's what I'm going to state. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and when she turned her over, she was like, this lady started screaming so loud. And it was like, what I saw was this little girl, you could not tell where her eyes, her nose, or her mouth was. Mm-hmm. It was just like her face was so messed up. Mm-hmm. And she's saying, she starts screaming, I can't do CPR. I can't, because I don't know where her mouth is. I said, see the area you see where her neck is. And, you know, and I went through the steps of the neck, the chin. I said, up from there. I said, you're going to have to move out the stuff that's there, because it's like her teeth were all broken. And so I was like, you're going to have to get her teeth out of her mouth. And this woman's like questioning me. Mm-hmm. How do you know this? And yeah. I'm like, please. I said, just do as I'm asking you. Anyway, the little girl, she was already deceased. And, yeah. You know, I got EMS there and they tried. But I knew she was gone, because as the paramedics got on the scene, the little girl appeared to me in dispatch. And I'm, mm-hmm. you know, and so that's where the hard part comes in. Because if I'm the call taker and they pass, then they usually come right to dispatch where I'm at. Mm-hmm. And she was standing there, and I'm trying to, you know, do the radio and speak to the officers and EMS. And the little girl was like, you know, she was more concerned about, she was telling me she had a puppy. Where is her puppy? She was just so concerned about her puppy. And I was trying to tell her, wait just a minute. I said, I'll deal with you in a second. And so that's where it really got very hectic at times and very emotional. So, you know, that's one of the things that I had to deal with as far as a dispatcher, but I loved the job. Mm-hmm. I mean, there was times we would have, you know, there was a bus that went missing, so to speak. And I'm like, so they called me out there because, you know, I worked for the sheriff's office at that time. And it's like, Melinda, you know, there's a bus missing. It had like 20 some children on it. And so it was on this real windy road. And so I go out there and I'm, you know, they've got it all blocked off so I could walk the roadway. And as I'm walking, I hear these children laughing. And I'm like, what in the world? So I go over to the side of the road and I look over, and it's like a real steep embankment. Mm-hmm. And then it went from laughing to crying. And I'm like, I turned around and I looked at the two officers with me. I said, they're down there. And they looked down in there and they go, Melinda, we don't see a bus. You would think we would. I said, it's way down in there. I said, the bus went off the side of the road and they just kept traveling. And they're like, is anyone alive? And I said, no, everyone is deceased.
God.
And so, you know, that took, they were like, you know, and they were hesitant, even though they knew me. Mm-hmm. You know, some officers were more open to it than others. And so they were like, all right, we're going to call out the rescue teams. And, you know, they're like, we hope you're right. And I'm like, I'm right. They're down there. So they rappelled down and they got down in there. And sure enough, they found the bus and the remains. And while I'm standing up there on top, all of the ones that had, you know, they had all passed. So their spirit came up there where I was, and they were very overwhelmed. They were, you know, children were like talking all at the same time, telling me, you know, what happened. And so that's where, and I, at that time, I did not know it was called rescue mediumship. And that's where I start counseling them and letting them know it's going to be okay, you know, because they're concerned about their parents, they're concerned about their siblings, you know, all of this starts coming into play. And so basically that's where I go into rescue mediumship, and I sit there with them for however long it takes, and to get each one of them to go through the light. So then what was weird, about a week later after all of that, there was an accident out on the same road. And no one was hurt, but their cars were really banged up and they couldn't move them, and it was in this curve. And so they called and reported the accidents, and then we started getting 911 calls again, saying these people that had was involved in the accident, they were screaming, saying, we are sitting in our car waiting and our car is moving. And I'm just like, and I knew, I was like, I said, just stay calm. I said, I know what's happening, but I said, to go into it over the phone will really freak you out. I said, once the officer gets there, I said, I will explain to him and then he can let you guys know. Mm-hmm. So what had happened was the spirits of those children stay. They went to heaven, but then they came back. They come back like if a car breaks down or whatever in that section of the road, because it's such a sharp curve. And so they were trying to push the vehicle out of the way so there wouldn't be any more accidents. Mm-hmm. And so once the officer got on the scene and, you know, he got out and was doing his thing. And then I called his cell phone and I was telling him that, look on the back of the vehicles. And he's like, why? I said, just look on the back. I said, you're going to be amazed at what you see. So he goes to the back of the vehicle and there's little handprints all over the back of their vehicles where they had tried to push the cars.
How does law enforcement and people like that react when you knew what was going on? You shared what was going on. They saw the handprints. I mean, that can't be something that necessarily goes into the police report. You know, I would imagine they'd be like, can't really put that down, even though that's there.
Right. Well, you know, it's really according to the police department or the sheriff's office, because some offices, they are very open to it and they will include that.
Okay.
As like a side note.
Yeah.
And that kind of, but some are not open to it. So no, there's nothing put in the report there. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just completely stayed away from. So it really varies.
When you're talking about being a rescue medium, from what I understand, what you just talked about, that means you are helping spirits that have passed move into the light. Is that kind of it in a nutshell?
Yes. A lot of times what I've noticed because I call them earthbound.
Okay.
What that means is that sometimes when someone dies unexpectedly or they've been murdered or, you know, that kind of scenario, they, for some reason, they decide not to go through the light. And so that's what I do. I go, you know, if I come across someone that is earthbound, and usually I can tell about how long they've been earthbound because of what I call their aura still around the energy of them. Mm-hmm. And so basically I sat down with them and I counsel them and we speak out what has happened, get them to understand, you know, some spirits don't realize that they are deceased. Mm-hmm. So that's where I have to come in and I have to explain, this is what's happened. You are deceased. You need to go through the light. And, you know, I've done this now for the rescue part. I've done probably for the last 4 to 5 years. And sometimes it can take up to 5 to 7 hours of just sitting there talking to the spirit, letting them get everything out they didn't get to. And if they're angered over their passing, and you know, all of this has got to be revealed. And then once I get them into where they feel like, okay, I've got to say what I had to say, you know what, everything that happened, and now I'll cross over. Then there's times there are some that refuse to cross over. And of course you cannot force them to. That's really some of the hardest ones for me. If they decide, no, I don't want to, I want to stay earthbound. And that's where it can get very, very scary, so to speak, because the longer they stay here earthbound, the longer their aura, as I call it, gets darker and darker and darker. And so that's one of the reasons I'm very adamant of trying to help every spirit I can to go through the light if I see they are earthbound.
Is it easier for a spirit to pass over or kind of get to the light, if you will, if it's you're getting to them quicker, if you know, like the bus accident and things like that, where you're pretty much there on the scene versus coming across someone who's, you know, died quite a while ago, but still wandering around?
Yes, it's a lot easier. Usually if it just recently happened, then, you know, it may take 30 minutes and then they're ready to go through. But, you know, when they've been earthbound, even for a week, it's hard. It's hard to get them to understand. But if it's been years, then you better be prepared to sit for a while. And like I said, sometimes they just completely refuse, there's nothing you can do about it. That's very hard for me.
When we talk about the light, I mean, is this something, in just trying to get your understanding of it, that they see that it's there all the time? The light's like off in the corner. You just got to go to it. Or is this something that needs human intervention, living human intervention, to almost open up that gate and go, hey, the light's over here? I mean, why is it that some spirits need someone who's living, who's never really been there to experience what it's like to be, there, completely dead and gone and not coming back? Why is it that some need us as living people to make them or help them get there? Why is that not something that's just completely, I guess, self-contained on that side?
So basically what I've learned in all these years is, like, for example, say, someone passes and it's just due to, they had a sickness and, it was expected, or in that kind of situation. When they pass, the light is there for everyone that passes. It's automatic. They see it. Mm-hmm. Most people that have no, like, if they feel like their business was taken care of while they were on Earth, then they will go straight to the light and go through. Others that maybe they feel, I didn't get to say this or I didn't get to do that, then, they'll be a little bit hesitant. But most of those types will go ahead and go through the light. Now, say someone that's been in a car accident and they get killed. Mm-hmm. Well, to them, one thing I've noticed is that sometimes they're not aware that they are deceased. Other times they feel they're angered. They feel like it wasn't their time. Why did they die? So that makes them sort of turn, and I hate to say it this way, but it's lack of a word, they turn their back to the light. They think if they stay where they are, which they feel they are still on Earth, then they will be alive. So it's a lot of confusion states of mind, because they died suddenly. They, it was not expected. Someone that's been murdered, there was a girl that was murdered, and she came to me, and I live in Arizona, and she was from Missouri. And all of a sudden, late at night, I had this spirit female talking to me. I was asleep, and I felt coldness on my arms, which immediately woke me up. And she's standing there, and she said, "I need your help." So I get up, I go into my living room, and we're sitting there talking, and she says, "I was murdered about 5 hours ago." And I'm like, okay, and it's very hard, because I'm telling them I'm sorry that this happened to them. And she goes, "Well," she said, "it was my husband." And I'm like, oh boy, I know where this is going. And then she's like, "But he's got it fixed, so they're not going to see that it was him." Mm-hmm. Law enforcement is not going to be able to understand or see that it was him that done it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. I said, and why is that? And, and she went through the process of telling me how he had planned it. After she had passed, she realized he had been planning it for months and months. Mm-hmm. And she goes, "But my biggest worry is my little girl." And she says, "Our baby is 6 months old." And she says, and I said, "Well, do you know why he done this?" And she says, "I had asked him for a divorce." She says, "I was taking the baby." And she says, "But I told him he could see the baby anytime." But she says, "He's a very controlling person." And she says, "And we got into it because I was going to go to my mom's the next day." And she says, "And me and our baby." And she says, "And he was telling me I wasn't going." She says, "We got into an argument." And she says, "And it was like, once I was," she says, "I know I'm dead." She says, "I know it." She says, "But once I was dead," she says, "I was watching him." And she says, "He had everything prepared to, he knew what he was going to do with my remains. He knew exactly everything he was going to do." And she goes, "So I know he's been planning it." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay. I said, "What can I do to help, to get you?" Because I was like, "If you would go through the light." She goes, "No, I won't go until I know my baby is safe." Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, so what can I do? And so she was telling me, I need you to call my sister. So she gave me her sister's name. And here, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, I hate this kind of thing. So I call her sister. I explain who I am. And I tell her her sister's here, and that I said, I look at the spirit. I'm like, what if she doesn't know?
Yeah, I was just going to ask that.
You know, I was just like, oh my God. And about that time, as I was getting ready to ask her, there was a knock at her door. Law enforcement was there. They told her, and I'm just on the phone and I'm going, oh my God. So, you know, she's in this screaming state of mind and she's just lost it. So then she remembers I'm on the phone. So she comes back. She said, you said you were a medium, because that's as far as I had gotten. Mm-hmm. And I said, yes. And I said, your sister is here. And she goes, she was like, what happened? Why did he, you know, why did you pass? What, you know, and she was just like, and I'm like, calm down. I said, she says that when you go into her bedroom, I said, she says that you can see like the entrance to her bathroom. I said, and there's like a little door or something there. And I said, she's saying she's put a camera in there that that her husband is unaware of. And it's all on camera, mm-hmm. him doing what he done. And she's like, oh my God. So, you know, she went and I'm like, now you have to be careful. I said, because, you know, they haven't arrested him. You know, you've got to be very careful in giving this information to law enforcement. And she says, how big is the camera? And I'm like, she's showing me, you know, it's, and I was like, oh my God. I'm like, I'm not good with inches or anything like that. I said, all I can do is very small and it's black. And I said, she says it's on the surface of the door. There's like a little opening. And I said, and it's filming is all I can tell you. So mm-hmm. she got a hold of law enforcement and she told them, and they went back there and they searched and searched. And then they called her and they're like, we can't find it. So then they call me. And I'm like, okay. I said, what I am seeing, I said, there is like a brown cabinet door. And they're like, yes. I said, open it. And so they open it. I said, now on the actual door part, I said, there is like a little miniature looking hole looking thing that you wouldn't even notice. I said, you really got to look. And they started looking and they took the door off and they were examining it. And I'm like, okay. I said, she's saying it's more to the center of the piece of wood. And finally they find this little chip. And so they take it and they got it all. It was all taped of how he murdered her.
Wow.
And then she told me, she thanked me. She says, make sure that my family gets my daughter. And she says, tell them I love them. And then she went through the light and that was, you know, and that was it. So it's just a lot of different reasons why a soul decides not to go through the light.
That wraps up part one of our conversation with Melinda Williams about escaping the dark. In part two, when a spirit passes into the light, where does it take them? Is it ever too late for a spirit to pass into that light? Is it easier for a spirit to move on if death was expected? And can one improve their standing on the other side if they choose to come back for additional lives? We'll ask those questions and more as we continue our discussion with Melinda Williams. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.